From KCRW Santa Monica, this is Left, Right, and Center.
You like potato?
And you like potato?
You like tomato?
And you like tomato?
Potato?
Potato?
Tomato?
Tomato?
Let's call them.
Libya, we all clear now? The budget wars heat up, plus that good yet bad jobs report and Republican wannabes on the march. Hello again and welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the screaming talking heads that dominate political debate. I'm Matt Miller, your moderator in the extreme political center. Robert Scheer is on the left, Tony Blankley on the right. Special guest Mary Madeline of CNN, as well as editor-at-large of the Threshold imprint of Simon & Schuster. Joining us as well, a big week both on the foreign policy and domestic policy front. Let's start with Libya. Robert Scheer, the president gave his much-awaited speech this week. Did it clear things up for you?
I'm so sorry you started with me. but, you know, it seems to me that Obama does deserve good points, particularly his Secretary of Defense, drawing a line saying, you know, it's one thing to fulfill the UN resolution— and that we're there to prevent genocide, but we're not there to prevent to train an opposition, to put it in power. If others feel strongly about it and can make the case, they should do so. And so I think if Gates' wisdom is followed and it continues on the wisdom he expressed in his West Point speech, that we can't be involved in these wars all the time. And also, if you're going to do Libya now in nation building, why aren't you doing it in Syria? Why aren't you doing it in Bahrain and so forth, and then ultimately in Saudi Arabia? So I think Gates is making great sense. And I have to point out it was inherited from the Bush administration, and so was the whole predicament in a way, because it was the Bush administration that decided that we could do business with Gaddafi, we could live with him, and so forth. Now, I think Gaddafi is finished, but I don't think that should be involved, as Gates said, U.S. Boots on the ground to do that. It has to unfold from Libyan history, and if the no-fly zone means you're preventing genocide and not doing nation-building, then I think it can be supported.
Tony, what's the right way to think about there's kind of the public rhetoric on this, which I find, I guess, confusing. And then there's what I assume is happening on the ground, where we're trying to promote regime change without declaring that as a public objective. How do you read it?
Well, it's very hard to read the presidential intent based on his words. I thought the most interesting sort of Washington political phenomenon that happened this week was a day after the president's speech, which clearly did not accomplish all its objectives, with NBC's reporter on the scene saying this is good news for Gaddafi. We got this leak from senior administration officials to the New York Times, to the Washington Post, that the president had 2 weeks ago signed a CIA directive to do stuff or possibly do stuff. What's interesting is the fact of the leak basically an official leak to report on a covert activity. And it seemed to me it was triggered by the fact that the speech didn't do the job and they were trying to keep a sense of forward momentum and presidential commitment without him actually saying anything. So we sort of got the implication that if not boots, there's at least the tiptoes of agents on the ground for us, but he's not willing to talk about it publicly. So I find it all baffling. Meanwhile, people, political appointees at the State Department are whispering that really the reason the president went with it was because the Secretary of State threatened to resign if he sat on the sidelines. I don't know whether that's true, but I've heard it from several sources in senior diplomatic circles. So this is a baffling week to try to figure out what the presidential intent and thus ultimately the American policy is going to be.
So, Mary and Tony, that's a very interesting that's a confirmed rumor then, that Hillary threatened to walk if—
It is confirmed. I heard it from three people yesterday.
It's a confirmed rumor.
One of them being a recently retired four-star general, one being a senior foreign policy establishment guy, not a Republican, and one just somebody else who's a consultant around town, but pretty wired. So having all of that come within, you know, about 8 hours of each other, yes, it's a confirmed rumor.
And Tony, Mary, I had to confirm that the bakery where I was getting a baguette too, you know.
Mary, what do you make of all this? And are you mixing with the same four-star generals that Tony is?
There are a lot of them around.
Well, I mix with Corporal Cueball, so I want to say that this is not confirmed via James Carville, but I think Mrs. Clinton, Secretary Clinton, at least tonally suggested her displeasure with the approach of the Obama administration before the speech and the intervention, as a matter of fact, on Wolf Blitzer, and going back to, no, I'm not going to be Secretary. No, I don't want to defend. No. And so she, I'm going to confirm Tony's suspicions politically, for my political gut, not my my marital bed. But in the president's defense, and I don't want that to sound like a centrist here, it is not a subject given to easy clarity. That's why it's so important to not be the professorial, nuanced, baby-splitting foreign policy. The no doctrine doctrine is very dangerous. It provides no clarity of action or triggers for intervention or limits of intervention to our friends, and it invites testing by our foes. And it's impossible politically to build support for adhocracy, which is what this is. Bob pointed out, what triggered the rationale that the president said triggered intervention in Libya could easily apply to many other places, and arguably we have a greater strategic security interest in Yemen and Syria. So it doesn't hang. The reason people are confused and baffled is because it's a confused approach to take one state out of there, and essentially it boils down to, we did it because we could, and that's not a way to go forward. It's no way. You have to be more clear, because you don't speak to the entire world through nuances.
Well, I want to make the case for adhocracy, however, because I continue to think it is a kind of a it's a delusion, maybe that's too strong a word, to think that there's some overarching doctrine we're going to apply in this kind of subtle world, and that sometimes an American president and an American, you know, American nation is going to do some stuff because we can. I mean, Mary, the president you served had that big, grandiose second inaugural address about freedom everywhere that I think ended up not being so much of a lodestar for what American behavior should be. And if it's imperfect and messy, I think at the end of the day, Obama will be judged on results, as he should be. And if Gaddafi's gone 6 months from now, he and the U.S. will do fine. And if Gaddafi is, you know, in charge of one half of a broken nation, he'll rightly be held to account. But the idea that, you know, you're going to have a tidy overarching doctrine, I think, doesn't...
No, that's where I started, that it's not a subject given easily to clarity. But he added added to the confusion. And you are right to point out, and this really did annoy me when I was working in the Bush White House, the urgency of measuring success in real time. It's not possible to. And if it, as the president did in his own speech, which I think compounded the confusion, he said that we are making progress. Well, just the day after he said that, there was a setback. There's always going to be setback when there are boots on the ground, even if there aren't boots on the ground.
Can I,
Bob?
Just, yeah, you know, there's an assumption the three of you are making, maybe having served administrations that have intervened unilaterally. But there's an important principle here that I would like to endorse, which I don't think we should be acting unilaterally. And I don't think, as I'm really with Gates on this, I don't know why, if there's an argument to be made for training rebels, why it has to be the U.S. Why does the U.S. have to be the symbol of imperialism, which is, by the way, very convenient for despots that reasonable people would oppose, to have the U.S. Being there doing that. It makes an easy target. And I favor multinationalism. And the reason for intervening in Libya, embraced by, say, Samantha Powers and others, and I guess Hillary Clinton, was there was supposed to be some sort of terrible massacre in the offing in one city. And the justification was we couldn't allow that to happen. And the argument for intervention should be to prevent that sort of tragedy. And it should be done in a restrained way. It should be done multinationally. It should not be to advance the interests of one country. And there are signs that that is what is carrying this event. I mean, NATO has taken over. There is restraint to the military option. There's a recognition that we're involved in a civil war with different tribes. It's not so simple. The national security issue is certainly not simple, because al-Qaeda elements may be on the other side. We don't know. And by the way, Matt, you supported the Iraq war, as did Tony. And I would not consider that a success, nor did the current president of the United States, who campaigned against it.
Can I stay on topic
last,
for a moment?
Last word, yeah.
And regarding Secretary Gates, who was fuming around town, both publicly and privately. We saw his statement on television the other day when he said that as long as I'm Secretary of Defense, we won't be doing any training on the ground, which is pretty close to a public threat. And he's privately grumbling more and pointing out that the entire military establishment, from him, Joint Chiefs, and including the National Security Advisor, a civilian position, recommended against this military activity. And there's a very unhappy senior Pentagon dutifully obeying orders, but very frustrated.
5 seconds, Matt. It is revisionist history to call any action of the Bush administration unilateral, as Bob just did. There are twice as many coalition members in our activities than there was in this Libyan intervention.
Well, let us know what you think of the current state of affairs with our involvement in Libya. KCRW.com/LRC on the economic front at home. Jobless report 8.8%, more than 200,000 private sector jobs created just in. This against the backdrop in D.C. of huge budget battles. Still a fight. Maybe there's a deal, or it's not quite clear yet whether there's going to be a deal next week to avoid a government shutdown next slated for April 8th on the kind of two-week funding that we've been on. Plus, Paul Ryan, the Republican it boy on the budget, slated to unveil his budget on Tuesday. Much anticipated. Also lots of state budget controversy. Bob, take it where you will. Maybe even starting with the jobs report. I mean, to me, this is it's good news that there's private sector job creation, but everyone has to remember at this rate of job growth, it would be till something like 2018 or 2019 until we got back to what we used to think of as quote unquote normal unemployment. Take it away, Bob.
Yeah, I mean, the great progress is to have 8.8% unemployment, and of course that's the hard figure. It doesn't take in the much larger group of people who either can't find jobs, or as the New York Times on Friday has a very good detailed analysis of all of those people who have been forced to take low-paying jobs that does not lift them out of poverty, a very large number. We have 44 million Americans living under less than $20,500 a year for a family of four, which is, it cannot sustain life. We have over 50 million people who are on government subsistence of some kind or another. And so the real problem, though, is are we getting out of this or not? And we're not, because of housing. And people don't want to talk about it. The banks have been made whole. They're giving their top people $5, $10 million bonuses and so forth. But housing is predicted to go down another 10%, with the exception of Washington, D.C. Every single other area seems to be in very deep trouble. New housing sales are at the lowest point since, I think, 48 or something, 1948. So we don't have a construction industry. People's worth, their basis of retirement, has been really cut in half and or further in most cases. And if you can't fix housing and deal with the mortgage crisis, you're not going to get serious improvement in employment. And this administration has made the banks whole, but done really nothing to help people who are in mortgage trouble.
Up ahead, hold that thought, guys. Up ahead, will the government shut down? Will GOP presidential aspirants get their act together? You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
Find more Left, Right, and Center programs and podcasts at kcrw.com.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm Matt Miller, columnist for TheWashingtonPost.com. Robert Scheer on the left, author of The Great American Stick-Up. Tony Blankley, columnist for The Washington Times, and special guest Mary Madeline of CNN, and the threshold imprint of Simon & Schuster. Mary, you're a compassionate conservative. What about all this high jobless rate continuing? Shouldn't we be doing more? Somebody?
I'm not sure what that moniker means, but I think Bob is exactly right on the housing issue as part of the impediment to the recovery. We had a government of both parties that produced moral hazard policies by 0% down and unaffordable houses that could not be afforded or sustained on their current income, to now to market choking policies. We have to have 22% down and a credit score off the charts. We have to let the market find itself to correct in the housing market. He's absolutely right, because it continues to be and is believed to be, which is as important politically to people, their greatest investment. But the other impediment to the recovery, of course, is that this president has thrown every roadblock in the way to speedy recovery. If you compare 21 months into the Reagan administration, who started with over 10% unemployment, to the 21 months of Obama's, Obama has reduced with his stimulative exercises unemployment by about 0.6%. And Reagan had reduced unemployment by 3.3% at the same time with pro-growth policies. So there we have history, we have data, it's empirical, it's not political, and that those two things in combination, the chilling effects of government action in the private sector and in the housing market, are going to keep this recovery at a very, very unprecedented slow rate.
See, Tony, just to throw a couple thoughts in before handing it off to you. I think the Reagan era and what Obama inherited were very different, because Reagan had a Paul Volcker. Everyone agreed to let Paul Volcker wring inflation out of the economy, and that's what caused that recession, sort of a monetary policy tightening induced recession, and then a kind of, you know, the kind of growth upswing after that. Here you had this unbelievable set of bubbles, the debt bubble, you know, in housing, in the financial markets, et cetera. And that takes – it's Obama's bad luck, but that takes years to work off. And so my own view would be they should be doing something much more dramatic, a much more dramatic payroll tax cut. I would do a big corporate tax cut, do both of those things, and then at the same time enact higher consumption taxes or higher gas taxes to phase in to fix the fiscal problem, you know, once unemployment's back down to 7 or 6%. But I do think it's apples and oranges to say that the Reagan experience is the same as what Obama's big debt and, you know, the bubble that he walked into obviously didn't cause. But Tony, what do you make of all this?
Well, I mean, this begins to look more and more like the late 70s, with the exception we don't have leisure suits yet. We're looking at the possibility of stagflation. We're getting very feeble economic growth. The housing market, as Robert says, is a catastrophe, and a continuing one and a declining one. And at the same time, we're flooding the economy with cash. It's keeping the stock market going up because there's nowhere else to put the cash. You're not going to go into housing. And yet, at some point, the inflationary expectation is likely to emerge. Now, admittedly, we haven't seen it yet, but when it hits, it's going to hit hard, as it did in the 70s. And that's, of course, what Reagan inherited. He inherited high unemployment, high interest rates, high inflation, low growth. And Obama inherited sort of the busted bubble of the opposite. And so I'm very worried about where this economy is going, and see no signs of hope.
Now, what about if we put in this the budget context? You've got the fight over potential shutdown coming. Mary, I want to get back to you, but what's your judgment? Is there going to be a shutdown? Will there be a deal on this on next year's budget? How do you see that?
I'm not at all convinced that there will be 218 Republican votes for a 30-some billion dollar budget at this appropriation at this point. I think there's a lot of – I was up on the Hill Friday morning talking with several members. There's a lot of sentiment on the conservative side to stand and fight for something much closer to $61 billion. I don't know whether they get persuaded to the contrary at the last minute, but this is going to go right down to the wire, both between the D's and the R's and amongst the R's.
Bob, do you see a government shutdown in the next week, or do you think they're going to reach a deal?
Well, you got to ask Tony that, since his boss was the guy who helped shut it down last time.
No,
but
it was President Clinton.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Who vetoed two Republican-passed appropriation bills that would have kept the government
right.
open.
So anyway,
more
but,
revisionism.
Come on. It turned out not to have been a successful strategy for the Republicans, and so there are signs.
Not true.
Okay.
Actually.
Well, whatever. There are signs that they're not going to do it. I'm not a Washington insider, so I don't know. I do want to defend Ronald Reagan a little bit here. I think Reagan learned some lessons. He learned from the savings and loan crisis, and a lot of liberal people want to forget this, particularly Paul Krugman and others, that Reagan actually tightened financial regulation by the end of his 8 years in office and did not cut it. He also, Don Regan's book lays this out rather clearly, he was offended by his old company, General Electric, having all of these profits and offshore shelters and so forth, and criticize them. By contrast, here's Obama celebrates Immolt and puts him in a high position and praises him. And here's a guy, you talk about cutting corporate taxes, Matt. Here's a company that made $14.4 billion last year and expects the government to give them another $3.4 billion write-off. So they haven't paid taxes for the last 2 years. And it's a company we bailed out by taking all that toxic stuff and helping out GE Capital. So I don't see what cutting corporate taxes does. We have a liquidity trap. They get all the money they want from the Fed, and they're not using it to create jobs.
Mary, just on the – what's your view of the what the Republican calculus should be on whether to risk a shutdown or not? It seems like a lot of folks in the Republican commentariat, like Rich Lowry of National Review, others weighing in saying, hey, you know, bank $33 billion in cuts from what that's basically what the original position was, and that's a good first step, and let Paul Ryan's budget come in next week and frame the debate beyond that. Where are you on all that?
I think they're both winning positions, but they would have to be argued out differently, obviously. You'd have to say this is just one step, and it's merely closing the this fiscal year because the Democrats, for the first time since 1974, did not do their job, which was to produce a budget in the first place. So that's all this 33, 61, whatever it is, business is. On the other hand, this notion that, and Tony's exactly right, it's revisionist history. The shutdown might have had a short-term hurt, but it certainly had no long-term effect on Republicans. They kept the House in 1996. But this is not 1994. All this looking backwards does not account for where the public is today. They are much better informed. They are much more aware. There's organic mobilization at the grassroots level. People understand that the connection between unsustainable, not just deficit, but unsustainable structural debt and jobs and the future. And that was not the case in 1994. There's a much greater public understanding of why this budget has to be cut. And in the scheme of things, 61-33, that's a drop in the bucket. What Paul Ryan has to lay out next week and beyond is the much more important bigger debate.
Well, we'll be talking about all that next week. Let us know what you think of the latest jobs report and the economy and these budget matters at kcrw.com/LRC. The GOP presidential field, Tony, just a few minutes left. How do you see, you know, against all this backdrop, who do you think is Mitt Romney the answer? You know, he's got the fundraising. There's the Book of Mormon is on Broadway in a way that may be mainstreaming Mormon culture in a way that helps him. What do you make of it all?
I think my sense is that with the exception of Tim Pawlenty, who seems to be the favorite of Republican professional politicians because he doesn't seem to have any drawbacks, from right to moderate in the Republican Party, there's a sense that they don't see the next nominee in the field or hanging around near the edge of the field since no one has really declared yet. There's a lot of desire for somebody else to emerge. I don't think there is any front runner. I don't think you can even call Romney a front runner. He's at 20% or less, and a lot of discontent that we just don't seem to have someone. Everyone wants to win the election next year and not just nominate the next fella in line, whoever that would be, maybe Romney. And they see the flaws or think they see the flaws of a lot of the other candidates. It's a very – I think there's some disappointment and hoping that somebody will come in later.
You know, Mary, my view, I've been on a couple of panels with Tim Pawlenty, and I've always thought he would be very effective as a GOP candidate precisely because he was so uninteresting. He was so disciplined.
I'm boring. Vote for me. That's a good one.
But he was so disciplined and so on, you know, on message in a way that, you know, he clearly is taking this very seriously. How do you look at him, Romney, right now?
You know, we're applying old templates to a new world. What Tony just brought up, primogeniture of our nominee selection goes back to 1952. It's whosoever turn it is. We have a wide open field. The frustration is not with the individuals who are all laudable in one way or the other, but the clear understanding that Obama is beatable, and there's all sorts of data to support that, and the message, the conservative message, is superior and tests out everywhere, but no one is becoming the kind of messenger that is inspiring to people yet. That doesn't, and that's a frustration, but that doesn't mean that somebody won't, can't, and it's way too early to tell. And I think a lot of it will pivot off of how much work or the seriousness with which this 112th Congress is perceived to be doing.
Bob, just about a minute before we rant, should progressives fear any of the emerging Republican field at this point? How do you see it?
Well, I'm still hoping for a return of Dwight David Eisenhower. I would vote for
me
him.
Too.
I mean, if there was a moderate
Republican. Kept out of Suez.
No, if there was a moderate Republican, I think a lot of us could get excited. I think if they go too far right, they shoot themselves in the foot again and, you know, it won't work. McCain could have been a moderate Republican. Unfortunately, he lurched to the right, but basically a moderate fellow who could have been an appealing candidate, particularly his views on cutting defense spending and so forth.
Well, I want to put in my invariable plug for Mitch Daniels as the only intellectually honest candidate we're going to see in the Republican field. Very interesting when he talks to conservative groups, the way he won't take Grover Norquist's anti-tax pledge. He's trying to actually exercise leadership in sort of preparing his side of the aisle for the fact that it's going to take stuff on taxes and on entitlement reform to actually get our fiscal house in order. Let us know what you think of the emerging GOP field, Tim Pawlenty, Mitt Romney, you name it, Michelle Bachmann. Or Mitch Daniels at KCRW.com/LRC. We have reached that time once again for our famed end of show, left, right, and center rant featuring pet peeves from across the ideological spectrum. About 30 seconds each. Tony Blankley, it is your soapbox.
Yeah, I think the administration is taking the eye off the ball in the Middle East, focusing on Libya and places. The focus should be Iraq, where we lost almost 5,000 troops, over 30,000 wounded, where we have a chance to have a historic success, and the president's planning to desert the country by the end of the year prematurely and risking Tehran gaining undue influence there. We need to keep our troops there and keep moving forward to a functioning democracy, which I think is doable if we don't walk away at the 11th hour.
About 20 seconds, Robert Scheer.
Yeah, we have two good pieces on Truth Day, one by Bill Boyarsky, the legendary political editor of the Los Angeles Times, and one by Jim Nehmer, the high school social studies teacher of the year once, defending teachers. And I just resent the heck out of the scapegoating of teachers for the budget crisis. I have a son who teaches in an inner city school, and when I mention that to other parents, they say, oh, where did he go wrong? And I think the very people who are criticizing teachers wouldn't want to be teachers, and these people do an often thankless task, and they should be applauded rather than demonized.
About 20 seconds, Mary Madeline.
This is the one-year anniversary of the Gulf oil spill, and the women of the storm from the Gulf region, which started in New Orleans, came to petition Congress this week to ask them to please let the fines that BP has to pay not go into the Treasury, where it'll be frittered away, but to be sent back to the Gulf to restore the coast for the betterment of the nation, that our 50% of our energy, our seafood, our agriculture, there's a national security.
Gotta run.
That's it. Let us get our fine.
Paul Ryan's budget next week will be intellectually dishonest. No taxes as part of retiring the baby boom. More on that next week. Thanks, as always, to Robert Scheer, Tony Blankley, special guest Mary Madeline. Jeff Rogers produced today's show. Our technical director is J.C. Swadek. Thanks to Manoli at NPR in New York. I'm Matt Miller. Thanks for listening. Tune in again for more Left, Right, and Center.
You got pajamas.
We know we need each other. So we better call the calling of all. Let's go.
You can podcast Left, Right, and Center, share it with a friend, or embed it on your blog from our new media player at kcrw.com. Send questions or comments to our blog at kcrw.com/LRC. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.